Tabernacle. And we begin with a passage in the book of Revelation at the very end of the Bible, where John in a vision sees judgment. He sees the faithful going into the reward. He sees the wicked and the sinners going to their punishment. And in the midst of describing the wonderful scene of God welcoming His people, we see this statement in verse 3 of Revelation 21, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and He will dwell among them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be among them." Our faith, the faith of the Bible, is somewhat unique in the world. Most religions that have been practiced by people have some concept of an afterlife. They all do. But pretty much none of them have the concept of the afterlife that is audaciously declared in Scriptures. And that idea is that we will be with God. Most versions of the afterlife that is held up as being possible for people in the world is something that's pleasant or something that's desirable, but the idea of being with God Himself, that's pretty much unique to the Bible. And it's an amazing thing to think about, that the God who created the universe, who dwells in infinite light and eternal purity, that He wants us right there with Him. And some people might suggest that, well, that was a late development in the story of the Bible, that the concept of heaven is somehow a late adaption of the religion, but it's not true. And the thing that perhaps indicates that more than anything else is what this verse says, and the fact that it mentions this tabernacle. The tabernacle is a tent. It's God's tent. Why would God need a tent in heaven? Well, as with most things that John talks about in his visions of heaven, it's a symbol. It represents something. And it represents something that has been in the Bible from the very beginning and keeps occurring and popping up throughout the Bible, and that is the idea, the concept of God dwelling with His people. So it's not something that's kind of tacked on to the end of the Bible. It is the message of the Bible. And the tabernacle is that theme, that recurring theme in the Scriptures that make that perfectly clear. And we talked about last week how the sanctuary of Eden, the paradise that God created man for man and woman to dwell in, was in fact the first sanctuary, the first tabernacle, if you will. Because it was the place where God and man could commune and come together and live together and be together and interact with one another. And in that place, all of the elements of the tabernacle were present. That it was a place where God and man dwelt together. It was a place where there was eternal sustenance and life and beauty, and there was this gushing from it, and there was the presence of the cherubim guarding that place, and it was a beautiful place and a wonderful place, but it's a lost place. It was lost because of sin. And this occurs in the first couple of chapters of the Bible. The first three chapters of the Bible is about God and man dwelling together in a perfect and sublime reality that is lost. That is lost because of man's sin. And then the rest of the Bible is about trying to get that back. The tabernacle in the wilderness, when God called the Israelites from Egyptian bondage and sent Moses to give them the law, the tabernacle that He instructed him to build was the next step in this effort to reconstitute what God and man had in the beginning. And the idea was that Israel had their tents and God had His right in the middle of the camp. And the idea that they could be holy and pure again was communicated through the ritual of the law of Moses, sacrifices, the laws of cleanliness and purity and holiness. You shall be holy for I am holy. Well, why do God's people need to be holy like God is holy? Because He wants to live with them. And God cannot tolerate and live amongst those who are contaminated by sin and impurity. And so there's a, at least in form and in a model form, there's a series of rituals that are instituted in order to maintain ritual purity. The sacrifices, the cleansings. Understand that there was also a river flowing from that place where the wilderness tabernacle existed, because God provided water. He had Moses strike the rock and water gushed forth. And there was unending sustenance in the form of the manna, just like there was in the Garden of Eden. There was this heavenly bread that came down and provided for the people. And that place also was guarded by cherubim. The cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant. The cherubim woven into the fabric of the temple coverings themselves. These were, of course, still models. They weren't reality. They were models. But they were models of something blessed and important and part of God's plan. The reconstitution of man and God dwelling together. All these elements are expressed in the physical structure of the tabernacle in the wilderness. But, of course, all of this was lost. Only a copy to begin with. And the cloud that represented God's presence symbolized that. It wasn't the fullness of God's presence, but it certainly communicated that concept. The animal sacrifices did not really make anybody pure, but they hinted at and pointed to something that would, as we well know as Christians. And Israel did not keep that covenant, and as a consequence of not keeping the covenant, the tabernacle more or less represented a lie. The man of God really hadn't come to terms. It really wasn't peace. They weren't really dwelling together. But it communicated hope that it could be worked out. That God certainly intended for it to. And that God was developing a plan in order to make that happen. And so this is all the things that we looked at last week. Which brings us to the temple. Temple was simply the tabernacle built in permanent form or in solid form. And you know the story, how David wanted to build a temple for God, and he said, you know, God is living in a tent with curtains, and I'm living in this fine house made of cedar, and it just doesn't seem right that God is living here and I'm living here, and so I want to build a permanent structure for the Lord. And of course, God sent Nathan the prophet to respond to David's request. And the Lord said, no, you're not going to do that, but your son will. I'm going to have your son Solomon to build this house. And this promise that he made to David was initially fulfilled in Solomon, and Solomon building the temple. As we all know as well, it also constituted a promise or a hopeful prophecy about something that would really, truly solve this problem and really, truly constitute a method by which man and God could dwell together. And that was through another son of David who would come much later. But we're still talking about models and practice at this point. And so this promise that God makes to David, I will raise your descendants after you, initially is fulfilled in Solomon. He shall build a house for me. This is in 2 Samuel 7. Verses 12 and 13. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And that's the part of the promise that has a long-term application, doesn't it? Solomon built the temple. And he built it over the course of the next several years. And it was a tremendous effort. Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, 2 Chronicles 3 and verse 1. And he built it on Mount Moriah, which is highly significant because that's where God had called Abraham to sacrifice his son, Isaac. But at the last second, God stayed Abraham's hand, and Isaac was spared. A ram was brought in as a temporary substitute, but on that same mountain, on that same Mount Zion, there would be eventually a son of Abraham who would have to die. And it's on this place, in this very area, that David built his had his son Solomon build his temple, where the Lord had appeared to his father David at the place that David had prepared. And that place was up here, north of the city of David, north of the royal palace that David and then Solomon built. And then further on, up here on the mount, I think it's died. No. I'm going to have to do this manually. Isn't that sad? And this is exactly what it looked like. You'll have to trust me on that. It looked exactly like that. But it was impressive. It was an impressive structure. Inlaid with gold all on the inside, completely. And a stone structure. Beautiful to look at. And no expense was spared in its construction. But it had basically all the same layout and furnishings as the tabernacle. It just on a much more monumental scale. And all of those things, of course, are significant, just as they were for the tabernacle, the laver out front for the cleansing of the priests before they went in to offer sacrifices, the altar out in front upon which sacrifices were made, that they could be ritually pure and clean so that they could go into the holy place of God. And in that holy place, the candelabra, the menorah, if you will, that represented the lights of God's Spirit, and the table of showbread that represented the sustenance that God provided, the altar of incense where the priests would come in and put incense upon the fire right before the most holy place, representing the appeal of Israel to God for His good favor. And then in that most holy place, that inner sanctuary, a cube, 20 cubits on the side, a golden cube, if you will. And in that golden cube, the very throne of God, the Ark of the Covenant, and the cherubim surrounding the Ark of the Covenant and protecting it. And in this case, Solomon had constructed these huge cherubim, and their wings covered the whole expanse of the place. Quite impressive and amazing thing, and yet no one got to go in there in the most holy place except for the high priest, and that only once a year on the Day of Atonement, when he would offer the sacrifice of the blood of a bull for the sins of the entire nation. But that holy place, that most holy place, represented the sanctuary of God, because it is where God would dwell and dwell among Israel, among the people of God. But all of it, of course, just a model, but an impressive one, meaningful one, for it too represented the concept of man and God living together. In 2 Chronicles 5, that describes this whole ritual, this whole scene in which Solomon and his people and the priests dedicate the temple. All of this is described in elaborate detail. And then it says in 2 Chronicles 5 and verse 13 that the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud. For the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. It is God's house. How do you know it's God's house? Because His glory filled that house. And to such a degree and to such an extent that the priests couldn't stand to stay in there. It was so powerful an experience for them. And in chapter 6 and verses 1 and 2, Solomon said, "The Lord said that He would dwell in the thick cloud, and I have built you an exalted house, a place for you to dwell forever." Now, that sounds like an extremely hopeful thing to say, doesn't it? Of course it is to be forever, but not that physical structure. But it represents the concept of a place where man and God can dwell together forever. That certainly is forever. That's what's being communicated here. And of course, the idea of being able to approach God because one is pure and one is clean. But how can one be pure and clean? Certainly pure and clean enough to approach God by sacrifice. Through sacrifice. That's how that can be done. How can man and God dwell together? Through sacrifice. Blood. And of course, the idea of a river flowing from it. You say, well, there was no river flowing down from the temple or out of the temple. Actually, there was. It's kind of interesting, really. At the foot of Mount Zion, there was a spring, and it is a spring fed by all of the internal waters coming down from the mountain. And that spring was called the Gihon Spring. And it was the main water supply for all of Jerusalem. And it's not a coincidence that one of the rivers that flowed out of the Garden of Eden was named Gihon. Because either they associated those two things together, or it's the same place, which is a tradition of the Jews. You see, the Jews believe that that is where the Garden of Eden was. I don't think it was. I certainly don't know that it was. The world is much changed from the way it was before the flood. But you understand that at the very least that tradition communicates the concept that I'm talking about. That place represents the Garden of Eden. It represents God and man dwelling together. And the river flowing from that place is Gihon. Because these things are connected. And then there is the fact that it was guarded by the cherubim, as I said. And the concept that God's presence is guarded. That you just don't come into the presence of God. You just don't march into where He's at. That's a place that is separated. That is a place that is hard to get into. And just like the cherubim was sent with a flaming sword to guard the entrance to the Garden of Eden after sin was committed so that Adam and Eve couldn't go in there anymore, those cherubim also represent the idea that we can't have access to God's presence unless it is by some marvelous arrangement. And as I said, Solomon built these huge cherubim, and I'm sure they looked exactly like that. No, they probably didn't, but you get the idea. And I'm sure they were quite impressive and quite frightening, and that was the concept that was communicated by these symbols. But the symbols represent something, and the thing that they represent is very real. There are cherubim, and I'm sure if you ever saw one, it would shake you to your core. It did Ezekiel when he saw them. Talk about him in a moment. As I said, all of this is a symbol. And you don't think these people knew that they were symbols? Of course they knew that they were symbols. They had no illusions about the fact that actually God lived in this place and His full essence was contained within this building that they built. They didn't think that. They knew that wasn't so. And Solomon communicates this understanding very, very specifically in his prayer that he prays in 2 Chronicles chapter 6 and verse 18. And he says this. He says, will God... This is Solomon. He built the building. But he knows that God doesn't really live there. He says, but will God indeed dwell with mankind on the earth? And that is the question. You see, can God dwell with man on the earth? Well, not now. And really not in the future. Except maybe, possibly, how, where, when? It's a great question, isn't it? Can God and man dwell together on the earth? Behold, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain thee, how much less this house which I have built. So that tells you right there that they understood that even this presence that filled the building, the smoke and the glory that drove the priests out, they knew that even that wasn't the full presence of God, but merely a symbol. They knew that. But a significant one. A powerful one. The hopefulness of it, that God could actually live with us. But of course it depended on the Israelites keeping the covenant. And this is also communicated by God when He speaks back to Solomon. He says, you built me a nice place, but here's the deal. 2 Chronicles 7, 19 and 20. If you turn away and forsake my statutes and my commandments, then, as he goes on to say, this house which I have created for my name. And God did. God said, okay, this is my house. I acknowledge it. I recognize it. My presence, the symbol of my presence, is there. And I will come to you here, and I will receive your sacrifices here, and you can pray to me here, and I will respond to you here, and that's all well and good, but you've got to keep my covenant. And if you do not, I will cast out of my sight this house. This is the subject. This house, which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight, and I will make it a proverb and a byword among all the peoples. I won't let this place exist. I won't let it stand. I will destroy it before I let you besmirch the concept of what this house represents. And that is me living with you because of holiness, your purity, based on the covenant that I've made with you. And if you can't keep that covenant, then you're not pure and you're not holy, and I will not have my name dragged through the mud of your sins. Not going to have it. I'll have this house destroyed before I let that happen. And that's, of course, exactly what happened, because they didn't keep the covenant, and God abandoned his house and had it destroyed. And there's this whole elaborate description of this process in Ezekiel. Ezekiel, the book of Ezekiel, the prophecy of Ezekiel, is really all about the sanctuary of God from beginning to end. It's quite impressive, really. And at the very beginning, Ezekiel sees the cherubim in his calling. And then he sees them again leave the temple. And if you recall the history of Ezekiel, Ezekiel is one of the first captives that was taken over into Babylonian captivity when Israel was attacked, when Judah was attacked by the Babylonians. And there were three waves of captivity. The first wave, the Babylonians came and attacked Jerusalem and attacked Judea, and they beat the Judeans and they conquered Jerusalem. They didn't destroy it. They didn't destroy the temple. They just took some hostages. They just took some royal family members and some key individuals. And one of them was Ezekiel and his family. And over there in captivity, Ezekiel has a vision. And the people who are with him, the Israelites, the people of Judah, they think, well, we're going to get to go home soon. Surely we're going to get to go home soon because, and this was their thinking. Their thinking was, well, God can't possibly allow the Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem and destroy the temple because that's God's house. Who in their right mind destroys their own house? And so God won't destroy his own house. And Ezekiel, he sees this vision. And in his vision, he sees God leave his house. And we read, for instance, in Ezekiel 10 and verse 4, then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub to the threshold of the temple, and the temple was filled with a cloud, and the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of the Lord. The glory of the Lord is in God's house, but it rises up and comes to the threshold. Well, that's not a good sign. And then it says in verses 18 and 19 of Ezekiel 10, then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. And when the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight. So God crosses the threshold in the form of this symbolic cloud of the presence of God. And Ezekiel sees this in a vision. And the cherubim that guard the presence of God are there, and they rise up. And they leave. It says in verse 23, the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood over the mountain which is east of the city. Now that's the Mount of Olives, isn't it? That's significant. The glory of God left the temple and crossed the Kidron Valley and went out over the Mount of Olives and left. Well, what's the meaning of that? The meaning of that is, this house is abandoned. This isn't my house anymore. And so the house was destroyed. The temple was destroyed. The Babylonians came back. They destroyed the temple. And it says in 2 Chronicles 36, 19, they set fire to God's temple, broke down the wall of Jerusalem, burned all the palaces, destroyed everything of value there. Jerusalem is destroyed. The city was destroyed, the walls were destroyed, but the worst thing of all was the temple was destroyed, completely wiped out. And then the people, the Jews knew, they knew that God can't live with people who sin. And he will not tolerate it. That's the meaning of that, isn't it? That's a great lesson, isn't it? But there's still hope. And as we go on in Ezekiel, there's quite a bit said about the return and about the rebuilding of the temple and what that temple will look like. And it's all heavily symbolic. But here's the statement that I want you to key in on here. In Ezekiel 37, this is after the temple's destroyed. That's after everybody knows that they're not going to return anytime soon. And it's the portion of the book of Ezekiel that gets hopeful. And the promise is you will return and things will be restored. And it says this in Ezekiel 37, verses 26 and 27. And this is God speaking through Ezekiel. He says, I will set my sanctuary in their midst forever. My dwelling place also will be with them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. Now, does that sound familiar? It's the same statement that we started with. In the book of Revelation, at the very end of the story of the Bible, after the world is destroyed and after the resurrection and after judgment, Ezekiel's statement, the statement that God made through Ezekiel, now comes to its full and perfect conclusion. Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and He will dwell among them, and they shall be His people, and God Himself will be among them. Well, Ezekiel predicted that and prophesied that. But there's more to go, isn't there? Because there's going to be the return, there's going to be the rebuilding of a temple, not nearly as nice as the one that Solomon built. But the interesting thing about that temple that was rebuilt after the return from Babylonian captivity is that the glory of the Lord never did fill it. The smoke and the glory, the Shekinah of God's presence never came back. And yet, in a much more significant way, it did, actually. God did come back to that house. And He did dwell there. Not in smoke, not in a luminescent light, but in the form of His Son, who came back over that Mount of Olives and crossed the Kidron Valley and made the ascent up and walked up into the very temple itself. And He started to drive out the money changers. but we'll talk about that next week. Just remember, this is where it's all going. This is what it's about. But we need to understand the context. We need to understand the backstory in order to fully appreciate the significance of that. And we'll talk more about that next week. Now, for tonight, I just want to stress a couple of things. God really does want to live with us and for us to live with Him. But to do that, it takes us being pure and holy. And to do that, it takes sacrifice. And even now, there is a house of God. There is a temple of God in this world. It's not a building. It's not a structure. It's us. We are part of the body, the temple, the house of God. And we have purity, not through the sacrifice of animals, but by the sacrifice of the blood of the Son of God. But we must maintain that purity. We too must remain true to a new covenant. And so let's not forget our responsibility and what all of these stories of the past are telling us about the significance of that responsibility. And if you're not part of the temple of God today, because you haven't had the cleansing that is found in the blood of Jesus, you can be. And even now, the church represents something that is about the future, about when we will come into the very presence of God and He will spread His tabernacle over us and we will live with Him forever. If you want that, if you want to be there in that moment, then in this moment, while we're still in this world, you need to be part of God's house. To do that, you need cleansing and you need the sacrifice of blood, the blood of the Lamb. If you're willing to undergo that cleansing by being baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the forgiveness of your sins, come forward and say that you will as we stand and sing.